Hey everyone, it's Jackie, and today is Steve's birthday. So on this episode of Jackie Always Unplugged, we're going to be celebrating my man, Steve Reese.
Welcome to the Jackie Always Unplugged podcast, where we're having off-the-record conversations. I'm Reverend Dr. Jackie Reese, founder and president of the Marcella Project. As a pastor, preacher, and thought leader, I've walked with women of faith for decades and had thousands of conversations about what women encounter solely because they are women. At work, family, their faith, with relationships, sex, the church, their bodies, and Jesus. On this podcast, we're going to be asking hard questions, dealing with real issues, and revisiting scripture with a new lens. These conversations are going to put words to your female experience. They're going to ennoble you as Jesus intended and encourage you to bring your full self to the table. It's here we're going to reshape our view.
Well, happy birthday, Steve. I wanted to have a conversation with you about your work on your birthday to kind of celebrate you.
Sounds like fun.
I know. Woohoo! Just what you wanted to do on your birthday, a podcast.
I know. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Your birthday is January 29th. And I think it was not even a month ago you were in Africa, I think around the first week-ish of December. And you took a picture. You were in Congo and you took a picture of a bunch of kids and you sent it to me. And it was so overwhelming to me because you had been there the year prior. And these kids are orphans and they've had to leave and run away from their home and be put into these refugee camps. And they've got absolutely nothing. And you were devastated when you were there a year ago. You were just like, they can't eat. There's no place for them to go to the bathroom. And so you immediately called up everybody you knew in America and said, okay, we need to build a toilet for these kids to be able to go to the bathroom. And anyway, so you did all these things, and a year later, you take this picture and you say to me, they're doing great. And I just sat there and cried and thought, they are alive partially because of you. So that's what made me kind of think, I want to talk about the things that no one knows that you do. You do water as basic, but there's so much more wrapped around your work. And I just wanted to honor you today and talk about some of those things. Last night you woke up at midnight. Tell the audience why.
Well, first of all, Democratic Republic of Congo is just this place that since World War II has seen the most deaths from war. And yet it's not on anybody's radar screen. They hardly know what's going on. It's also the place in the world that holds many of the precious resources that are required, a green future of the world for your phone to work, et cetera. And so it's a place that I like to say one of the best things that can happen to a developing country is not have any resources, because right. If you do, everybody in the world wants it. So, I mean, it was back in 2023 that we first saw that there were over a million refugees within a country around Goma, a city of about a million. And then by the time June of last year, there were over 4 million. And I think it's hard for people to understand what it means. They see pictures of these beautifully designed refugee camps with rows of tents, et cetera. But when you're displaced within your country, there's a lot less resources. And when the ground is all volcanic rock like it is in Congo, it's incredibly difficult. And so people are given small, small plots of land, maybe 3 feet wide by 10 feet long. Try to find some stick. Hopefully after several months, they'll find some plastic, maybe a UN tarp to create a quote-unquote home. And as well, touring those in June, actually, of last year that we ran across the Bright Star Orphanage, and this most wonderfully dressed man in his suit and tie who was so proud. He had grown up an orphan and he saw these orphans that were being created by the war, and he created an orphanage and was doing the best he could with it. And then the rebels came through that area of Kibumba, and he had to use what little money he had left to hire a bus to take him and the kids to the outskirts of Goma, where there's no place to go. Land is distributed there by households, not by orphanage or organization. And so fortunately, people were able to, you know, just figure out a little piece of land that they could have. And about 10 widows who had lost their husbands said, we have nowhere else to go. So we'll stay here and help take care of the kids. But they had nothing. The worst dormitory sitting situation I've ever seen. Six to a bed, rotting mattresses, non-existent mosquito nets, dark rainwater coming in. I mean, at certain times of the year, there's 6 inches of water on the floor. It's just a difficult. So very little food, no medicine. And yeah, so on the spot, we said, hey, we'll fund a a pit latrine and a tank for water. And when we went back in December, these kids were still poor IDP kids, but they were much healthier. The joy was obvious in their eyes. They had regular food. They can go to the bathroom. They had some medicine. Unfortunately, I need to say that this last week, rebels have overrun the whole country and the whole city of Goma, and we can't hear or get word at all about how these orphans are doing or how anybody is doing right now. It's a difficult situation. Yeah, a lot of suffering.
And it's heavy on your heart.
Sure it is, yeah. You know, you see something as large as 7 million IDPs and you can't fix it, but you can care for those you can. And so a good friend gave $10,000 just last week when they heard the story and said, do what you can to help give these kids beds and some food and medicine, et cetera. And of course, we sent the money right away, but we don't know what's happening. We can't get word in or out at all. So some people in the world suffer over and over and over again. So the people we work with, the leaders there, they know how to handle a situation because they have been IDPs in the past. You know, this is not new to them. It's not a good situation. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah. I know it's been very upsetting to you.
Mm-hmm.
Just one of the many things that you do, that because your main work is actually in South Sudan.
That's correct, yeah.
And yet you do work in Congo also. Tell our audience really quick your elevator speech about how you ended up in Africa, because you had a full-time job. You were an executive pastor of a mega church in Dallas. And in the middle of that, you launched Water is Basic as kind of a, I don't know, third, fourth, fifth job. How did that come about?
Well, I was on the board of an East African organization that was focused on reconciliation and peace building. And I was asked if I wanted to come just observe this gathering of pastors from the north and the south, all pastors, who just as a peace treaty had been signed, were going to get together and just start this process of forgiveness of each other. And I'm thinking, sure, I got to check that out. I'm not even sure what pastors have to forgive each other for, but it turned out when war gets bad, even pastors tell their congregations to attack others, et cetera. So it was just a powerful situation. They asked me to come back a year later and help them brainstorm. How can we as pastoral leaders who are now unified and have forgiven each other do the best or the most significant help that we can give to our country as we come out of 55 years of war? And you have to understand, 55 years of war means no roads, no hospitals, no doctors, no virtually no education. I mean, we're talking a devastated country. And I'll skip real quick, as you asked me to, but, you know, we did some brainstorming. And on the last day, as people are sharing some of their ideas, this old man raised his hand and said, why would we build schools, churches, hospitals, farms? Our people are dying of dirty water. And for me, it's the only time I've ever been in a room full of pastors where they all agreed about anything. And I knew at the time it'd probably be the last time I'd ever see that. And to leave and not do something would be kind of crazy. So I just came back to Irving Bible Church, where I was executive pastor at the time, and just started telling people. And it wasn't long before somebody put on a 5K. And then we had a not just ourselves kind of a program at the year end of the year where we raised as much money as we could for others. And the next thing you know, we had $500,000 and we were developing local teams to drill water wells and we were going strong. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, mm-hmm. That was the beginning. And in that very beginning, you and I took our three kids to Sudan because it was Sudan at the time.
Correct.
So it was one country broken into two eventually, but one country. And we went to Sudan in 2005. And that was not my first trip to Africa, but it was my first trip to South Sudan. And you were right. I mean, there was nothing. There were no roads. We were in a bombed out house that really didn't even have, you know, a partial roof, some walls. And I'll never forget, we decided to put on a conference for women to do microfinance. And we flew in a bunch of women from the United States. Obviously, I was not doing the business conference. We also did preaching. Yes. I guess which one I did, everybody. Anyway, we flew my mom in. And I'll never forget, she came in on this little puddle jumper with some of the other women. And she said to me later, you know, I had no idea there was no airstrip. I mean, you just landed basically on a cow path in the middle of a field. And then when you look out your window, there's this huge pile of bombs from the war sitting there. And I'll never forget one day we all were driving somewhere. I think we were going to go to an orphanage to visit. A truck got turned over and we couldn't get through. And so we're sitting there on this path, this dirt road, waiting to, you know, for somebody to fix the solution. And I had to go to the bathroom, which is not surprising either. So my mom and I get out of the car and we go into the bush and we pee in the bush. And all of a sudden, and do you remember this? There were a bunch of Swiss, what do you call them, Steve? These Swiss guys that come up.
when peace comes, there's a ton of mines hidden in the soil. And so that's what the thing they do is they find them and get
right,
rid of them.
They sweep the ground looking for the yep. bombs that have been buried. Yeah. And they yell to my mom and I, hey, you need to get out of there. There's mines in there. And I was like, oh, shit. I don't remember how I got in here. How am I going to get out? And all I kept thinking of, if I blow up my mother, my siblings will never forgive me. And this was kind of my introduction to South Sudan. And I won't go into too much about that trip, but there was another time that you went, and I think you were preceded there by Hillary Clinton. She had come to visit where you were doing your work. And she actually interviewed your partner during the Clinton Global Initiative. I want you to tell about the bodyguard, but you can get us there.
Well, first of all, Bishop Taban, who I worked with, had written an op-ed in the New York Times about America, please stop providing all the guns for our misery. And so Secretary Clinton at the time had called and said, hey, can you help me find this person? I'm going to South Sudan. I want to meet with him. So I was in the process, did all that. And they developed a great relationship. And eventually the Clinton Global Initiative awarded Bishop Taban, I don't know what the award's called, Clinton Global Initiative Award or whatever they do to many different people. It was that year, I think Malala was also an award winner and et cetera. And some people that had figured out how to take plastic out of the ocean, et cetera. And so I just was dressed in a way that made me look like Secret Service, because at one point somebody came in and cleared out the room and said, nobody in here, just Secretary Clinton and, you know, President Clinton. And oh, and then they looked at me and said, you can stay, you're Secret Service.
Right. So, bodyguard. And yeah, I'll never forget you texting
for
me.
Several weeks. Yeah.
The funny thing is, here you are with Hillary in a room with Hillary Clinton, and you're texting me like, hey, babe, they thought I was the bodyguard.
Yeah.
You know, that was just funny. Okay, so South Sudan, there was a time, this has nothing to do with water, but, you know, you're in South Sudan, a place, a city, a town called Yei. They've got no hospital. They've got no supplies. They've got no medicine. So you somehow connect with a guy in Dallas. Tell us a little bit about how you equipped a hospital.
Well, there's a very large medical group in Texas called Baylor Scott & White. One of the great things they do is they have an entire warehouse where they collect things they can't use. And they're new. They're brand new, from beds to surgical kits to you name it. I mean, it's just a big warehouse. And you can come in there and literally shop like you're at a Target and fill up a container. And yeah, we were able to do that. And all we had to do is find the funding to ship the container. And that's pretty easy for South Sudan, because containers go one way. They never come out. So we, you know, I found a guy in Canada that would do it at a reasonable price and got us a container, and we loaded it up. And I didn't realize at the last minute, and I had to go buy a thing of paint and paint over the logo on the side of the container. And away it went. And it turned out to be very helpful. Actually, there's another fun story about a container. I still can't remember. There's a lady I worked with somewhere in my life who contacted me and said, hey, there's a big concert promoter who's doing a big, big, big festival and wants to help Darfur. And I said, well, I can't help Darfur, but South Sudan is a much bigger place with a lot more suffering if they'd like to help there. And she said, yeah, we'll do it. And literally, I think a year and a half later, a container shows up in the middle of this small town in South Sudan, full of new surgical instruments and all that kind of stuff. So time has its own rhythm, that's for sure.
Yeah, you can't make things happen like you can here in the United States.
No.
Yeah. You also got a grant, if I remember correctly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we got a dear friend, Corinne from L.A. In fact, she and her family just lost their home to the fires in Pacific Palisades, which is a heartbreaker. But she could make things happen. So you connected to a group and wound up getting like $7 million worth of medicines delivered to this clinic in South Sudan. So.
And when you say medicines, let me clarify to our audience. We're talking penicillin. We're talking ibuprofen. We're talking, I mean, even more.
Yeah,
but I'm saying they didn't have aspirin at this hospital.
Right. Yeah, it was a great deal. Yeah, it was very helpful.
That was awesome.
At one point, you know, when the war ended, I think there were two doctors for 13 million people. Opening a clinic was a remarkable thing. You know, there's another fun story about that, by the way. When I first got involved there, deep in the bush, you'll remember this, there was a place called Mama Lily's. And this was a couple from Michigan or somewhere like that. And he was told he had 6 months to live with cancer. And he said, well, if I'm going to live for 6 months, I'm going to do something meaningful. And they literally moved to Sudan in the war. And started cutting down trees and built, you know, put up a fence and built an orphanage for all these war orphans. Well, he didn't die, and they wound up not only having this fabulous orphanage, but they had the only hospital, I think, in the country that was specifically focused on helping women give birth. Yep. I used to make everybody give blood there, but they did so much good. And these people would come, you know, doctors from Australia, the U.S., et cetera, and they move with their families and live in the middle of nowhere amongst teak trees and save so many lives. It was fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, because women didn't go to the hospital to give birth. Women went to the hospital because they're going to die in birth. That's why they showed up, right?
Yeah, by the time they got to the hospital.
Right. It's not like what we do in America. We go to the hospital and wait for our, you know, to come out. No. These women are in trouble, and that's why they go to the hospital.
Things had gone wrong in their tupel, right, which is their term for a mud hut.
And
now they either walked for days or were on the back of a motorbike to get to the hospital. And by that time, it was most likely you were going to pass. Yeah. And the baby as well.
And the baby. Yeah, it was serious. I remember one time you came home, or maybe you even talked to me while you were there, and you had a young boy, a young man. I don't know. He was probably late teen, crawling on his hands too. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And somebody, he had been walking down the road.
We've jumped around a bit date-wise. We started in 2005 when the comprehensive peace agreement had been signed and Sudan finally had peace. But then in 2011, people in the South decided that they wanted to be their own country, and that's when South Sudan was birthed. And then in 2014, now that they didn't have a common enemy, now everybody, the leaders had to figure out, and by the way, everybody's a soldier because that's the only way you've lived. So the leaders were trying to figure out who's going to be in charge, and civil war broke out, and it was pretty bloody. But one of the main bad guys came into our area, Thomas Cirillo, and his guys would just kind of sneak out and do terrible things. So these two, three boys had... there was enough peace that they hopped on their bikes and their parents gave them some money to ride into town and get registered for school. And along the way, these guys jumped out of the bush and robbed them. And what they did is they sliced his Achilles tendons, which if you're simple to fix actually with an operation, but without it, you'll never walk again. And we went to visit him in this, you know, people can't see this, but I'm doing air quotes hospital. It was just a devastating place. It was hot, it was dirty. And here this guy was supposed to be in his bed. All he had was a sheet, and he wasn't there. And we're trying to figure out where is he. And then he came crawling back from the bathroom. So yeah, we were able to see to it that he got to Juba and had the surgery that would at least make it possible for him to walk again.
Yeah,
because his life would have been far more miserable than it already was
for the rest of his life. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
You guys saved him. You saved him.
Yeah. I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Again, that had nothing to do with water. This is why I love you.
Doing water for a long period of time gives you opportunities to at least other things, you know. It's kind of like, best way I know, if you're a school crossing guard at the same street corner for 20 years, there's a lot of other things that are going to happen, you know, besides being a crossing guard. You're going to learn somebody's name. You're going to find out that their parents went through divorce. You're going to get to, you know, there's just so many different things that happen when you stay at something long term.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Things like meet the president of South Sudan. So you got to meet the president, and he was wearing a cowboy hat.
Yes, that was a gift from George W. Bush.
What were you doing meeting the president?
Well, there's so many different things. Before the Civil War broke out, we met with the vice president and begged him not to choose war, which didn't work out. We had met with the head of internal security, which was that's a fun story, by the way. I don't think we had planned to talk about this, but it had been asked that I would go meet with the head of internal security and ask him to give two land cruisers to the chaplaincies for the SPLA, the South Sudan People's Liberation Army, so that the chaplains could use it. So we finally got it, waited, finally got to see him. And I started talking to him, and I noticed he fell sound asleep. I mean, sound asleep. And I don't know what the protocol is here. So I just kept talking. And then eventually he opened his eyes and we finished and we walked out. And I said, well, how'd that go? And my friend said, you did well. Unfortunately, he slept through the request for the for the trucks. And so that's not going to happen. But, you know, anyway. Yeah, I think we were on a mission with the president to ask for someone's release. And yeah, probably shouldn't talk more about that, but.
All right, so let's go. Let's move then to you also mm-hmm. sat at a table with all the generals during the, you did some peace work, peace treaty work.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sat at the so part of that was part of meeting the president, part of sitting at a table with all these generals that are uneducated. By the way, you might want to mention the level of education of the generals.
It's the largest percentage of illiterate generals in the world.
And yeah, you're sitting
because
at the table.
They've been fighting since they're 5, 6, 7 years old. Yeah.
And you sent me a picture, mm-hmm. and it's you. And for our listeners, South Sudanese people are very dark. Like they are dark skin color, and they're usually extremely tall. Mm-hmm. So here's you around this oval table, this picture of you, and you're this tiny little white guy comparatively, and all of these South Sudanese generals. And what was your point, and what were you doing there?
Well, I mean, we had this horrible civil war going on, and there was, you know, there's all these things that would happen, you know. Tons of people would fly to another country, Ethiopia or something like that, and they'd all stay in $500 a night hotels for 6 months negotiating peace while everybody's dying and suffering. And so one of the ways we could help foster peace was to get people at the grassroots level to sit under a mango tree and just talk. We actually raised quite a bit of money to fund sometimes flying people in on a small plane and getting them under the mango tree, that kind of thing. And one of the great things we were able to do was actually we had water filters, Sawyer water filter, one of the greatest water filters there is. They're made in Florida. We had thousands of them, and we wound up trading them to soldiers so they could have clean water. We'd give them a water filter. They'd give us an AK-47.
So you were swapping out water for guns.
Yeah. Water. There was definitely water for peace at the time. And, peace did come. And I think there's lots of reasons for that peace. But I do think the work we did getting different tribal groups and village groups and leaders to sit under their mango tree and talk was very helpful. I know much of that opportunity was provided to us because we were known as the people who were bringing clean water through local means to villages. And this is a place where everybody knows. I mean, I've had the president ask me, can you drill a water well in my hometown? Everybody knows up the power of clean water. Without it, there are so many diseases, typhoid and cholera, et cetera. There's diarrhea, there's worms. But perhaps the worst thing that happens is moms are the ones that are responsible for getting water. And it's not uncommon to walk an hour in 120 degree weather to fill up a jerry can for water. You know, so it's an hour there, an hour back, maybe 15, 20 minutes at the well, and have to do that 8 times a day. So, you know, you do the math. That's 12 hours or so out of your day that's used up before you've ever hugged a child, cooked a meal, helped them with the homework or held a sick child or anything. It's just miserable. It's really miserable. And so what many mothers do is they keep their daughters home from school and send the daughters so that the mother has more space in her life to do other things. And so the people here in South Sudan, they understand the power of clean water. They know that when there's a well that's been repaired, mom doesn't have to go use all that time. When mom has time, she invests in the family and in the village and the community. Girls go back to school, and the future of this country is definitely going to be an educated generation.
It's going to rise.
Going to rise. And so we see ourselves as directly connected to that. And I think that's why our work gave us a place at the table to help facilitate peace.
Yeah, that was awesome. One of the problems that occurred when peace came from the Civil War is that now you've got all these young men who have been pulled into becoming soldiers, whether they wanted to be or not, even young boys, right, who have now lived out in the bush, they have murdered, they're traumatized, and now they're back home and there's no jobs.
No jobs at all,
So one of the things you kind of worked on with a group was like, hey, we can't have a bunch of angry, traumatized young men roaming around a town not with anything to do. So.
Well, one of the more significant things that needs to happen post-conflict is for there to be an independent police force. So, you know, in America, we have a lot of conversations right now about, can the military be used inside the country? Basically, no. That's because we have police forces. Well, in a country that's only has war and only has soldiers, there's no police force. So we began the process of training policemen, and it started years before this story you're talking about. We had actually brought some police officers over from the U.S. and just had a lot of fun teaching them, the police officers, that you're actually not here to crack in heads. You're actually here to get to know the community and to help the community, help them understand their constitution and what it means to defend the constitution, all those kinds of things. And then that kind of ramped up. We were training about 300 police officers. They were young guys, and we had a lot of fun with that. In fact, my sister-in-law, her dad had been a lifelong police officer and had passed away and left her some money, and she was able to fund uniforms for these 300 police officers.
That was so cool.
It was so much fun. Uniform, sneakers for their training, sweatpants and all that kind of stuff. And I had a long-standing challenge to them. If I showed up and anybody could beat me in push-ups, and, you know, these guys are 20 and I'm almost 60 or whatever, and they look ripped, but they're all malnourished. And so I was always winning. But finally, at one point, somebody won, and the gift was $100. And the place went nuts. What I want to share with your audience right now, that's such a powerful thing for me, is the person who beat me didn't just pocket that $100. No, immediately the reason all 300 started cheering is they realized that $100 would be shared amongst them all. They'd all get something. There's a very big cultural difference between most of Africa and East and West, or however you want to call it. And that is their focus on self is pretty much non-existent. It's always us. It's always we. In fact, one time I was driving, long day in the bush, and a couple of friends were talking about how somebody had passed away in their sleep. And I was saying, oh, that's how I'd like to go. Our driver pulled over finally and just said, I don't understand what you're saying. You know, I'm saying, because you just fall asleep, go to die, and it's easy. And he goes, but what about the whole process of everybody coming to the village and being around you for weeks and getting to walk that journey with you? And I'm looking at him going, yeah, I was just thinking 100% what's best for me and not what's best for everybody else. Mm-hmm. And this is just a very big difference that's been very impactful on me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And our family.
Yeah. And our whole family. Mm-hmm. You've done all kinds of work that, because you've been there for 20 years doing Water is Basic, you've brought in police force, you've brought in trauma healing, you've helped, you know, with orphanages, you've trained teachers, you've developed finance businesses for women, like making soap, and you've brought in dentists. I mean, you've just done so many different things that, you know, are just a bigger picture than just water. Water has provided you this opportunity to invest in a whole community, and quite frankly, many communities there. You didn't tell me this story till a while later, and I think it was because you knew I wouldn't be overly excited about it. But you did mention that one time when you were there that you got arrested.
Oh,
at the traffic circle.
I might have been arrested a couple of times, but I actually got a ticket, I think, and that's because I didn't go around the roundabout, which was literally just a beat up used tire in the road. And I didn't go around it like I'm supposed to in a roundabout, and I got a ticket. And I was actually really happy about that, because I was literally taken to the police station and given a ticket and a fine, and I paid it. And I think that was a real sign of forward progress for a country. Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't really excited about you being arrested in South Sudan I know you're not very fear driven, and I'm not either, but I'm also like aware that you are in some very dangerous spaces. Have you ever been scared? Was there ever a time, was there an incident where you went, oh boy, this could go sideways?
I mean, that's happened a couple, I shouldn't say a lot of times, because you don't want to hear that. I mean, probably the most scared I ever felt was arriving at the Rwanda-Congo-Goma border at like 10 o'clock at night and choosing just to not tell the people that I've been there a few times. I can handle this, and I'll just walk across the border and get a taxi or something to my hotel. And I got across the border and definitely felt like I am in no man's land and I have no idea how to get around and get anywhere. That was a moment that was a bit scary. Mm-hmm. Actually, just last year, one of our board members, Mike, from New York, was with me, and he had some friends in Juba, the capital of South Sudan. We were invited to a quote unquote, a NGO, non-government organization cocktail party. And it's a chance for people to meet and exchange what they're doing. So I hadn't done anything like this. So let's go. And while we were there, we just started to notice that there were fewer and fewer and fewer people there. And finally, we're like, I mean, it seemed like it was happening really quick. And the place was packed. And they're like, oh, yeah, there's an alert out. Soldiers are out. They're shutting down the city. Everybody's been instructed to immediately go back to their compound. Well, you know, we weren't exactly like a big official NGO, so we didn't have bodyguards or a bulletproof vehicle or anything. But we decided, I guess maybe that's a good idea. We did make it back to our hotel, but there was a few stops along the way that were a little touch and go. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not the safest place in the world, for sure. And so I want to bring up a letter that a woman sent you, a mom, actually. It was a mom. And I bet you didn't know that I kept this letter.
Good thing you didn't, because I wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. So it's a letter from the mom of that woman, a young woman. She was a young woman, maybe a college student or just fresh out of college. And she arrived at the airport. Can you tell us real quick a little bit about that story? And then I just want to read the letter she wrote you.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't remember her name, but this was actually the Nairobi airport.
Her name was Molly.
Molly, you get there late at night and you get through customs, you get your stuff and you're on your way to find a taxi or whatever. And I just noticed this young woman with a cart loaded down with luggage going back inside instead of going out. And so it just caught my eye. And I thought, that's a little odd. So I just kind of followed in. I said, hey, just checking. Are you okay? And she obviously didn't have a clue. She said, well, I've actually, my ride's not here. She had no way to contact him, no phone, no way to, et cetera. And I just asked her a few questions. And it turns out she had come over to volunteer at some kind of a clinic or something. And apparently somebody was supposed to pick her up, but nobody was there. She had no way to contact him, and she had no way to make anything happen. I mean, she was just a fish out of water. And so I finally just said, hey, I have a driver that's about to pick me up. He's a good friend. He's from here. He's very trustworthy. We'd be happy to drop you. And of course, she had to look at me and decide, you know, what the heck do I do? Do I trust this guy or
right,
not?
Right.
So one, she didn't really have another option. And she'd go back inside the airport, and I don't know what would have happened there. But I think we seemed a little trustworthy. And we were able to drop her off and then sent somebody a couple days later to check on her, et cetera, and just make sure she was good, you know?
I just want you out there who are listening to picture that you've sent your daughter to Africa. And, or anywhere, quite frankly, in another country, and she's stranded. And now what? Right? So the mom writes you this note, and I'm going to read it. Dear Steve, I'm not sure how to start a letter thanking a stranger for essentially stepping in and ensuring the safety of my daughter. So I'll start out by simply saying thank you. Molly returned to Connecticut this week after her 6-week volunteer trip to Kenya and told us on the car ride home from the airport about her harrowing experience she encountered when she first arrived in Nairobi. She told
by the
us
way,
that it.
I had instructed her, please don't tell your parents about this until you get home.
Which
that
she
would
didn't.
Not be good. Yeah.
Yes. She told us that it took a lot of time and convincing to talk to you, as she could hear me in her head warning her stranger danger since she was a little girl. I understand that you waited for some time in the airport with her, and then you and your friend spent a couple hours in a car searching for the volunteer location site. As Molly describes it, you went totally dad on the team in charge of the volunteer house, demanding to speak to whomever was in charge and asking the exact question that I would have asked. How could you leave a young single woman stranded at the airport for hours? Simple words cannot define my gratitude toward you and your friend. I am a firm believer in two things. God places people where they need to be, and everything happens on this earth for a reason. I am so thankful that you were persistent and stuck around to wait for her. I know the circumstances about why you were there to visit your friend after his tremendous loss. Thank you. Thank you for recognizing that Molly was in trouble. Thank you for being persistent. Thank you for understanding as she got into the car, terrified that she may be making a bad decision. Thank you for protecting her and getting her to the final destination, where she did have a wonderful volunteer experience. Thank you for following up a couple days later to make sure things were still okay. A million thank yous. I hope someday I find myself in a situation where I can pay it forward. And then she offered a donation. Yeah. When she sent that letter, I thought, I'm keeping that. That's a keeper. Just another reason I really love you and want to celebrate you on your birthday. So I thought it might be fun to take a break from this conversation between Steve and I and to listen in on how one of his children perceived their dad and all of his work in South Sudan. Hey, Hamp. So fun to have you on with me.
Hey, Mom. I'm glad we got this going.
Yeah, finally. Had a little tech glitch there. But Dad has been to Africa 94 times. And I think out of those 94, you have gone, I think, at least 4 times. And the first time we took all of you kids to Africa was back, I think, around 2005. It was when Sudan was one country. It hadn't actually had a civil war yet and split. And I think you were about 12 or 13 years old. So a little young, but what exactly do you recall about that trip?
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know the exact number of times I've been with Dad to South Sudan, but it's been quite a few. And that first time was with obviously the whole family. In reality, quite quite young, so it's quite difficult, I think, to remember maybe how I felt or all of the events that took place. But there's a couple of things that I definitely think stand out in my memory. And when I say a couple, I mean, these are the only things that I remember, really. But is that we flew in on a small plane. It was, you know, maybe 12, you know, 18 passenger plane. And you land and you're like, holy cow, there is nothing here except for this pile of, you know, rocket launchers and bombs. And so as a 12-year-old, kind of like, what is this? But I think that trip really stuck out. A couple things stuck out was just, there was nothing there. There was nothing. There was no roads. I remember, you know, one night we wake up in the middle of the night, turn on a flashlight, and there's maybe 1,000 cockroaches inside the room everywhere.
That was a little freaky.
Yeah. You know, so it's one of these things where, you know, you've been camping before, but here you are in the middle of, you know, South Sudan, the middle of Africa, and it feels, you know, quite rural. But I remember, you know, one of the things that was listed about that trip was everybody had a bucket shower, no light. The water was barely hot. Might get like a small bucket of hot water. But I remember Dad and I bucket showered together to help kind of pour the water on each other's heads and things. And it was just nice. It was a good connection. And you know, we had been to some other countries in Africa on that trip. I think we had been to Uganda and Rwanda, been to Kenya that trip. And so obviously that was all kind of a bit of a culture shock. Then you landed in South Sudan and it's even more so. But I think it was just, I mean, again, at 12 years old, there's not a lot you take away from that because you're not really observing how your parents are engaging or how the group might be engaging as much as, I mean, you're probably observing, but maybe not remembering as much. So, but I do remember just that the complete devastation that South Sudan was in at the time. I mean, just coming off the peace agreement in 2005, there was really nothing there.
Nothing.
And so I think that's the biggest thing that just sticks with you is just like how desolate and shambles the country was. And of course, at that time, it was one country, but how in shambles the south of Sudan was. And
I want to like just circle back with what you said about the bucket showers, because what our audience probably doesn't understand is when you say they were slightly warm, what it meant was a couple people would go down to the river and get a couple buckets of water, and then they would have to build a fire. And then warm up the rice.
Yeah. So, I mean, some nights I think we had quite hot water actually, but you had like a small bucket. So you mix that with kind of some other water. So you have enough water. It was really desolate. So,
yeah. And I couldn't wash my hair the whole time I was there because it takes a lot of water to get through this long curly hair. And so it was like no water. Yeah. Okay. So then you went back again. I forgot about this trip, but I think you and Dad went again when you were in high school again.
I can't remember. It must have been, maybe it was after high school. I can't remember whenever one of us kids graduated from high school, Dad basically picked a trip, or not picked a trip. Dad, you and Dad paid for a trip that the kids picked. And so I remember at that time I had really wanted to go back and see the work that Dad was doing. Because, you know, in 2005, 2006, when we were in the south of Sudan at that time, water basically wasn't even a thought. It didn't even become a thought until the end of that trip. And so over the next four or five years, and I think it might even have been after college, but I don't quite remember, but I wanted to go back and see what the work Dad was doing. And so we did a trip to South Sudan that graduation. And that was the first time I really got to see him in action as kind of an adult, if you will, at that time. So it was much more of a, you know, I wasn't a child going to see what was happening. I was kind of an adult traveling with my father. And again, just a very interesting trip in so many fronts, but really impactful seeing the work that they were doing and the wells that they were producing. And yeah, it was an interesting trip. One story I remember is, you know, we were staying in a little kind of house, and out front we would do our little workouts. So Dad had the towels, and we were doing like kind of back exercises with towels and push-ups. And it's just a beautiful memory, I think, of you know, working out with my dad here in the bush in Africa. And, you know, as an 18-year-old kid, it's kind of a, especially an 18-year-old son. It's just a beautiful time to spend with your father and see the work that he was doing. So,
yeah. By the way, they don't have gyms there.
No, there was no gym at the time. The next time I went back, there was a guy from Kenya who was living in South Sudan helping with some of the well drilling. And he had built kind of a little gym with some wood and some concrete, you know, dumbbells and concrete barbells. And so that was an interesting experience. But at the time that trip that I went with Dad after graduation, there was, no gym.
So you went with Dad. That was the trip you chose for your senior trip, because that's what every child would pick. Hey, let's go to South Sudan. And then you went again in your 20s, and you went by yourself that time.
That trip was, again, another interesting trip, you know. So
I knew I was really interested in getting involved in doing international development, but I wasn't sure really how to do it or where to start. And obviously here was a good access point in a country that my family has had connection with now for almost 20 years. It was something that I was like, man, I would love to get some experience on what Waters Basic is doing in South Sudan. And so I had done basically a 2-month internship there. The first week I flew over there with Dad, and then he left after that first week, and I was there by myself for the following 7 weeks or whatever it was. What I was doing there was I was helping train the first team, reporting team. So the idea was we were basically building out the whole reporting mechanism of Waters Basic. So where are the wells being drilled? What's the stories around the wells? What are the how is it affecting the communities to have water? All these kind of things. So I worked with a group of three guys to kind of do that team. But it was interesting because even after Dad left, everywhere we went, it was, this is Steve's son. It was really beautiful. It's been beautiful to see my dad just operate, I think, especially as I get older. He's so passionate and people connect. He connects with people. I mean, he's like kind of this goofy white guy, can't dance and can't do, but people connect with him and he connects with them as well. And so everywhere I went, it was like, this is Steve's son. And immediately it wasn't that I just got respect. It was that people like loved me because they loved him. So the respect was kind of already there, but what was really interesting is like immediately I became their friends. You could feel the love that they had for my father, and they showed it by loving me well as well. And this was everywhere I went. So that was just really interesting. And again, like that was a really beautiful and I think I developed a lot in those 7 weeks. I think it was impactful for the organization to start having some records that could actually be utilized to increase funds, to drill more wells, to provide more water for more people and save more lives, these kind of things, right? Get people, more people to school, all those stories that you hear. It was just really nice to be a part of that and helping build out some of that. And it was really nice just to see the kind of love that people had for Dad at the time.
And I remember you sent home some pictures and some videos, and there was a picture of you standing next to a guy with a gun, you know, because the military's everywhere. And I was like, oh my God, what? You know, there's been a few times I've had to breathe with the choices we've made as a family, you know. But so you and I went back with Dad in September of 2023. And by this time, he had started this new initiative with training women to become well mechanics. And that's kind of a new endeavor. So we went, and probably one of my favorite things about that trip, besides also getting to see what Dad does, which I'm with you, every time I go, I'm in awe of him all the much more. But I also was a bit in awe of you, of just seeing how cross-cultural you are. And you are very much like your dad in that way of like, you just jump right in. You love these people. You eat all of their food, even the food that my stomach can't even take a whiff of. You like, oh, this is amazing, you know? And yeah. So you're really, really good in those spaces. What was that last trip about? And what did you experience?
Yeah, I've learned a lot from Dad, I think, obviously. And I think we have a lot of similar personality types. So I think in some ways, you know, growing up and traveling with him, not just to South Sudan, but just all over the world traveling with him. But then obviously seeing the work and being a part of that with him, I think I've taken on some of his ability to really jump into cultures and all different cultures. And I think the authenticity that he has, I think, really helps. I think people see that. And I think people see that in general. Yeah, I mean, this trip in September was a lot of fun because we had kind of this group of, you know, I didn't know other than you and Dad, I didn't know anyone else on the trip. And there was probably, I don't know, maybe 10 of us in total, something around this, and kind of all people from different walks of life, some people that were funders, some people that were there to help kind of brainstorm some ideas on how to improve some of the messaging, whatever it may be. And it all just went smooth. And to have a group of 10 random people traveling all throughout South Sudan. So, I mean, we landed in Juba, flew up to Wheel, I guess, or I don't know.
Yes, exactly, yes.
Up into the Northeast. And then we, you know, we're in cars driving, you know, a couple hours per day. But it went smooth, and it went smooth, I think, a lot because of like his energy, the way Dad like brings fun into everything. We're like, even times where it's like, what the hell is this? This sucks. It's like it turns into a game, you know, and the game makes these things not suck as much. Yeah. So for me, I think it's just been like I very much believe that I've adapted a lot of the ways that Dad has kind of this intercultural connectedness. I think that's probably shown through the ways that I connect. And I just feel comfortable. Again, I think Dad makes people feel comfortable, but I think partly is just growing up in this family, you learn to be comfortable because you've been in those scenarios a million times. And I'll go back to this. It's always been beautiful to see Dad operate because even, you know, in this trip that I went to do training the reporting team was right, you know, kind of got disrupted that trip because there was a big peace agreement that was being signed between some of the rebel groups and the federal forces. It was being done at the compound that I was staying. And there was, even then, there was like this push for women's inclusion in those talks, which is not always the case. And so then to see, I guess, this last summer, to go and see kind of this completely new initiative that is really focused on providing equity, but also really not just for providing equity for women, but building stability through investment in women, right? So it's just cool to see. It's cool to see him, you know, again, everywhere he goes, people love him and he's goofy and the kids love him. And same thing. Yeah. It's, oh, you're Steve's son. And there's automatic love for me from that. And it's beautiful. And it's a different scenario. This is the thing, is it's different than being in
Europe.
No, I mean, or even, you know, when we were in Ye, it's like, okay, well, being in Ye was one thing because it was kind of comfortable. You had a compound. It's interesting to say that Ye is like this comfortable place to go, but over a period of time, it was, because I kind of knew my way around.
Right, we've been there multiple times.
I've been there three or four times and for extended periods of time. So it's interesting just to be in a new part of South Sudan, and yet dad is operating the same and loving the same, and people are loving him the same. I think that's a testament to just his ability to be authentic with people, to love people. I mean, you can tell he's there because he really cares, not because he's just doing a job. Yeah, he's invested. Yeah,
he's invested. He's given his blood, sweat, and tears. He's given it his all, and they know it. And he hasn't disappeared when things got hard. He didn't disappear on them when the wars broke out and there was violence.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about 20 years. I mean, this is, you know, from 2005 to, again, this is 2023, but now it's 2024. And
yeah,
I mean, 20 years, and there's been a lot of changes in South Sudan since then, and there will be more changes to come. And he has been steadfast in his support for that country and the people of South Sudan. And don't think you can say the same for many people, let alone countries or governments. So I think there's some real love for people that love. And it's quite obvious through his continued work. And you know, never forget, never left, never abandoned.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, it's
never
really
quit.
Never quit.
So I love what you said about dad, too. Like I told people one time I had a woman call dad. She was a pastor here in Texas, and she and dad were going to do their doctorate together. Well, they weren't going together, but they were at the same doctoral program on the West Coast. And she's like, how would you feel about me traveling with Steve to the first, you know, class thing? And I was like, oh, I won't use her name, but I was like, you should absolutely travel with Steve because he is the funnest person to ever go on any trip with.
Right.
Okay, so if there was one thing, and we're going to close out with this question, if there was one thing you'd say to your dad about how he's chosen to spend his life, what would you say to him?
Well, I think for me is like, what an example it is to have a father like you, a father that's not motivated by money and is not pushing their kids to be motivated by money, a father who has lived his life to better others' lives. I mean, and there's not a lot of people in this world that spend their whole lives trying to make other people's lives better, and he has. And I don't think as a man, especially I think right now in this like era of toxic masculinity is just rife all through the internet. All you see is talk about making money and being tough. And here I have this dad who is like the perfect example of like a real masculine man, a man who loves, a man who sacrifices, a man who's fun and works hard. And is tough, you know, and works out and has muscles and looks good, but there's no selfishness and there's never been. And I think just as a man, as I get older, there's not many people like him and there's not many men like him. And so have that as a father, as something to look up to. It's almost like this shining light. It's the beacon on the hill. It's, oh, in a sea of toxic masculinity, I have a very clear representation of what a real masculine man looks like. And I think it's been very shaping on who I've become as a man as well. I mean, again, I like to think of myself as a tough guy. I like to wrestle. I like to fight. But also I love people, and I love people because he has loved people. And I don't think I would be that way without him. I think really I think of him as just a great example. And I couldn't thank him enough for being that, because, man, that's who I want to be. And I think without that example, I couldn't be.
Yeah. Thank you, babe. I love you, Hampton.
I love you too, Mama.
So Let's talk about food in South Sudan.
Yeah, it's a lot of good food.
Surprisingly, huh?
Mm-hmm. No, I don't know if it's surprising. I mean, every place has good food.
Some talk to us about your favorite food there, and then maybe share a little bit about the prank you played on some of the women.
Now that they've been at peace for a while and their chickens are chewable, grilled chicken is always a great meal. They know how to make French fries like nobody else because their potatoes actually taste like something before they become French fries. Lentils, fabulous things they do with lentils. Eggplant, eggs are even fantastic. I mean,
eggs are fantastic.
It's anybody that comes to me would be like, wow.
It's farm to table, good. It turns out.
Yeah, it turns out food tastes good if it just comes out of the ground. So there's plenty of good food. Not always accessible. I would think it would be weird for me not to say this. I mean, at this given moment right now in South Sudan, out of 13 million people, probably about 7 million are struggling to get enough to eat.
Tell about the fish story.
Well, you know, our work has transformed over the years, and I could be more proud of what we're doing now. We've always focused on serving solutions being local, but we just, over time, we realized again and again that it's women are suffering the most. Why can't they be a solution provider? And instead of drilling wells, there are literally thousands, maybe 50,000, 60,000 wells that have been drilled by well-meaning nonprofits over the many years with no plan to maintain them. It's like installing a toilet and there's no plumbers. So your toilet stops working, and so you start walking all to your neighbor's house, and then theirs doesn't work, and you start walking, and so that's why people are walking such great distances. Anyway, we now train women to repair wells, and they do it as a business, and they're really knocking it out of the park. Our 45, I'm making a little sales pitch here. Our 45 women-led well repair teams last year repaired over 720 wells, giving clean water to over 61,000 families.
And that's amazing.
If your listeners have been listening, they already understand the power of clean water for health and time and investment, et cetera. But one of the areas that we work in is really hard to get to. I tell people, you know, my next trip will be my 95th, and sometimes these trips are 42 hours one way. And so you land in Nairobi, then you fly to Juba, then Juba to Wau, and then from Wau you drive, and we drove, and we drove, and we drove.
Like 8 hours of driving. I've done that drive.
Yeah. And I think we visited a couple of pump mechanics along the way. So we had to walk, get out of that and walk through water, et cetera. So by the time we got to our very, very, very simple guest house, when I say simple, our bathroom was shared by everybody. There's a bucket and, you know, for a shower, et cetera. We get there late. And I had already worked very hard on this fun plan. that I knew people would be tired. It'd be dark because there's no electricity. But they'd be hungry. So it took me a lot of convincing to get the ladies who are, of course, want to bless these dear people who are traveling with me and convince them that we could. I told everybody, listen, they're going to have made some food. You may not want it or not, but it's really rude not to eat it. So they drop their stuff. They're exhausted. We come and sit down and they bring a big pot and put it in front of us and pop the lid off. And it's the most disgusting looking boiled fish head you've ever seen. It looks like something from a horror film.
Just the heads. A bunch of heads. Yes.
Yeah. Which is actually a delicacy. And there's silence. You know, typically people just start digging in or somebody says, you know, let me say a blessing or something. There's just nothing. And then I think Evan, one of our board chair at the time, reached over and said, well, let's go for it. And then somebody else did. And the women who had cooked were having such a hard time. And it was a really interesting experience. And finally, one of them just broke out laughing and said, no. And then they brought out, you know, French fries and chicken and rice, and we had a lovely time. That was one of the great pranks I've ever done on anybody, as well as sticking a live chicken in somebody's backpack when they weren't looking. That was fun too. So
yeah,
we've had a few things.
Yeah, you always have fun on the way. That I do know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now
a country that doesn't know pranking is starting to prank me, which is kind of fun.
We're going to wrap up here. Just a few more questions. But so you went to a board meeting in December. So you get home from, I can't remember when. You get home from Africa. We have family here for Christmas. I have surgery, which means you have to do all the cooking and cleaning with all the large family here for Christmas. And then you go right straight to a board meeting, which was a pretty crucial, like, what's the next vision step? What are we doing? And tell us what you came up with and what's next.
Okay, so this connects to what we're doing now. We've got 45 women-led well repair teams who are independent units. They run them as a business. We provide training and parts. covering two whole states. So pretty much everybody within these two states out of 10 in South Sudan now has somebody who can repair a well within hours or days instead of months or years. And so when we gathered, we just started talking about, okay, this is, you know, this is an idea. And I'll be honest, during COVID is when we had the space to try it out. And when I talked to people, experts, they would say, great idea, never work. It's too patriarchal society. It just won't work. And so we piloted it during COVID, and then we started investing a little bit more time and money. And the point is that this last year it was like, wow, this is really working. Governors are asking us to come, et cetera. So we decided that, okay, let's expand this. Let's take it to the whole country. We would do what it takes to train another 200 women and get them to cover the whole country and provide well repair for everybody so that people don't have to wait years or months, but can literally see themselves, their wells repaired in days and hours.
So you've got a 5-year plan to take to literally get it to
by 2030. Mandate 2030, it's called, yes. We haven't really gotten public with it now yet. So,
happy birthday. It's just like me to let it out of the bag.
That sure is.
Kids will be going, oh, that's so mom. So 2030, you'll be 66. 66. When you are finished getting to every region in South Sudan, how many times will you have traveled to Africa by then?
Well, I don't know. That depends on how many times I'm going to travel between now
in
and
general,
then. But
you got a general.
I'm going in March. That'll be 95. It'll probably be around 110 or so. Yeah. Which is too many.
That's a lot. I told you I want to go on the 100. The 101, I gotta go with you.
And I think that's a great idea. Anybody and any of your listeners who want to go can too.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
We'll have a party.
So you have an African heart. You love your work, but you really love the people. And mm-hmm. you've become very, very attached. I have said over and over again, they're like your second family over there. Last year on your 60th birthday, the South Sudanese team sent you a T-shirt with a cow on it.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about what that is?
The cow? Well, it's my name. That's what I'm known as. There is Munjindik, which is big bull, and it's specifically a bull, a kind of bull, a black and white bull, and it's a real term of endearment and of respect, etc. So, yeah. Now I have a name.
You have a name. I love
outside of my own.
And when I was there in 2023, they told me that you know your mm-hmm. husband's, and then they told me the name of the cow, and I'm like, okay. I'm not sure many people want to be called a cow, but it was a very honoring statement. But
yes.
What it does depict is that you're a white, Caucasian, privileged man from America, and you have a black heart. Your heart is in Africa. And one of the questions I asked you recently, and this is going to be the last question I want to ask today, how are you going to walk away from this? Like, how are you going to do this when your work is done? Because it means walking away from these people.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's always been a goal that we would go away and it would continue. And we're even ramping up that investment of time and energy and money, et cetera, to make that more a possibility. But yeah, I have many friends in many places and many countries, people, even countries, you know, that I just stop in for an hour. They're friends there and good people. And
friends you've had for decades.
Yeah, and friends that have been kind to us, and we've been able to help along the way, and as a family, and they know my children, and they know you, and we know them, and hopefully we'll stay in touch. I mean, I expect to have my ashes sprinkled over South Sudan someday, so.
That will be your final trip. And that was exactly what I wanted to close with. You and I have discussed how we want our end-of-life memorial service, whatever it is, to be. And we both want to be cremated. And I have asked you and the children and all of our closest friends know this too, that I want my ashes spread on the land that I worked in New York with my family, my parents' business, crop farming. And I want my ashes thrown on. So the people who own the property now, I'm so sorry. But my kids will be sneaking up there one night and dumping me up there. And you have asked that we take your ashes to Africa. And so, you know, all of our children have traveled to Africa multiple times. We will all gather and honor you and take your ashes, and you will be spread over Africa and finally rest there. But you're only 61, and I'm not ready for you to die, so.
And I got to go make a cake, so.
Yes, Steve is making his birthday cake tonight. I asked him this morning if he wanted me to make it, and he looked at me aghast and went, No. I wanted to do this podcast because I wanted to honor the man you have been and the work you have done. And I know that most people that know you don't know all the kind of things that you have done. And I tell people all the time, I'm married to an Indiana, a real life Indiana Jones. And I couldn't love you more, Steve Reese. Happy birthday.
Hey, if you've enjoyed this conversation, then hop on over to the Marcella Project. Sign up for our email and check out our other resources that we have to offer. You can also find me on the Marcella Project Facebook page and on every other platform and social media. Have a great day.